Colonel Douglas McGregor, Colonel Daniel Davis, to have a deep dive discussion, no pun intended, Colonel Davis, the host, the name of your show, about these troop deployments and where we see things going. Welcome to both of you on this Thursday.
Thank you. We're glad to be here.
And thanks, Colonel. Oh, I think Colonel's muted. Is Colonel Douglas, Doug, are you muted?
Are you to start?
No, I just wanted to say hello. Just hello.
I was sitting quietly on a log here, waiting to be told.
I don't boss any of you guys around. I just listen. I listen intently. So, when you look at these latest troop deployments and what we're hearing and not hearing, what stands out to you? Let me start with you, Doug. Where do you see what are you seeing over the last few hours that really it makes your hair stand up on end?
My hair normally doesn't stand up on end no matter what happens. I think we have enough forces to probably control much of Los Angeles if that's what we need to do. I don't think this is a significant commitment of any kind that is going to change the outcome of the war. I think what's important for people to understand is that President Trump right now faces the very real probability of total humiliation. Humiliation at home and humiliation overseas, because all of his talk and bombast about destroying, defeating, subduing Iran and wielding the righteous saber of justice, namely the U.S. armed forces against the evil mullahs, all that crap is going to go away. And people are going to say, what are you doing? What have you done? And I think what we're getting ready to do right now is launch what we call historically a so-called war-winning offensive. And this reminds me a lot of Market Garden in September 1944, where we decided that, if we could secure some bridges, we were home free, we could march into Germany, and the whole war would be over by Christmas. There were considerably more troops and assets involved, but as we all know, it failed miserably. And I think what they're doing right now is they're going back over all of the target lists that they've attacked in the past. They're revisiting all of those, looking at all the satellite photography, any new intelligence that they can get. They're replenishing the stocks of exotic munitions, joint attack, service-to-service missiles, all kinds of other weapons, with the goal of launching probably sometime in Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, somewhere in there, a nonstop 96-hour sort of pulverization of everything in Iran. And while this is going on, I think they're going to try and find a way to insert the light infantry into the Persian Gulf, into these islands in the Strait of Hormuz, or a couple of them, and, of course, the famous Karg Island. Now, what's the problem with all of this? Well, once again, we're the World War II force reenacting World War II, and the Iranians are not in World War II. They're in World War III, and World War III is very different. Everything that happens, they can see. They have constant, uninterrupted, persistent surveillance of the entire area. They also have precision-guided weapons. Everything is precision-guided, missiles, drones, whatever. And they can reach out almost 1,000 miles with these weapons and attack very effectively. And we don't have, at the moment, inside the Persian Gulf, the means to protect those Marines and paratroopers if we use them. And I don't know how they get from wherever they start to be in a position to do very much, because once again, the Iranians can see everything. And then it's simply a decision of how long do they wait before they target us. And if they try to fly in B-22s or UH-60s helicopters, well, they're going to fly low, presumably, and everything under 15,000 feet can be acquired and effectively attacked by Iranian air defenses. So I think this is a dumb idea. I don't think it'll work, but I could be wrong, and it could be enormously successful, in which case then you get the complete disintegration of Iranian society and the state and chaos across the region that'll spill all the way into Europe.
Colonel Davis, Colonel McGregor brings up the Allied operations, Operation Market Garden. Others have suggested this could turn into World War I Gallipoli. disaster, trying to, unseat the Ottoman Empire, really, and wind up in a bloodbath. Where do you see it? And anything you agree with, disagree with what Doug just said?
Yeah, an interesting thing, first of all, this is less than 30 minutes ago on Trump Truth Social. We were all worried about what might be happening this weekend because the deadline that he extended from the ultimatum was supposed to have expired tomorrow. And he just now says, as per Iranian government request, please let this statement serve as a represent that I am pausing the period of energy plant destruction by 10 additional days to Monday, April 6th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Talks are ongoing, and despite erroneous statements to the contrary by fake news media and others, they are going very well. So, the part of the issue is, man, how do you take anything President Trump says at face value? Whether that's earlier today where he said, again, they're already completely destroyed. They hardly have any missiles and drones left, and they are definitely wanting to negotiate. At the same time, Foreign Minister Araghchi repeated again on state television with all these images on the side of the camera of all these people around the country celebrating and supporting their country and their government. So he obviously has their support, is the point being of that. And then as President Trump was making that statement, you had Trey Yingst on Fox News with all the sirens in the background. He's wearing his Kevlar helmet. As he said, the 10th barrage from Iran today was in the process of being landed. And that was even before dark. Who knows how many they may get later tonight. But, I mean, every physical thing you can see shows that Iran is very far from a defeated foe, and in fact, they have their hand around the Strait of Hormuz, and therefore 20% of the global oil supply, also the natural gas, and also the fertilizers and all the other feedstocks that are necessary to feed a good portion of the globe. So they are definitely in the driver's seat here. When you think that you're going to go in with a few troops here and there and have a spot, Doug said there about Market Garden. That's exactly what I was thinking, the same kind of thing. And Gallipoli, I've shown both of those on the show earlier today, in fact, about how the similarities are and the difficulties. And we don't even have as many assets. I also had somebody on from the British Navy, a retired Commodore, who took place in a ground operation in the Falklands War, where he said he was part of a battle group that got a smaller number of people ashore and trying to do the same kind of thing. And he said they lost 4 ships in the process. That's back then. That was before you had a lot of missiles and drones and all this other kind of stuff. And even that was more difficulty. Every one of these operations that Doug was talking about in here, they all come with a pretty high price tag. And that's if you have it thought out well and there's a plausible military prep hope that it's going to succeed. This doesn't have that. This is one of those, to me, Doug, you say whatever you think. To me, this looks like it's just flying by the seat of your pants, figuring stuff out on the fly and say, throwing something at the wall and see if it'll stick. It's not been resourced. It's not been rehearsed. It's not been equipped. And this just has disaster written all over it. And I pray that this statement here about, we're going to wait 10 days, hopefully that's not just for the energy, but it's trying to find an off-ramp here. I really hope that's the case.
Yeah, go ahead, Doug. Do you respond to that? Hope you're muted. Is that on our side?
No, it's on our side.
Oh, okay. It's on Doug's side.
Oh, he muted
it. It's automatically muting me. It must be surreal. Anyway.
Go ahead.
Let's look at a couple of other data points that I think we need to take into consideration. England, that is Great Britain, is just about out of oil. They figure that in 2 weeks they'll be completely out of oil. You have a similar situation, by the way, in Australia. And I was amazed to discover that Australia doesn't have a single refinery. So that country could come to a complete screeching halt in the very near future. They have to look at the impact on India, where they have millions of people lined up at the gas pump trying to buy refined gasoline. The only one that seems to be doing really well at this point is Russia. Russia is making an additional $250 million per day on top of what it was already earning every single day. So while the Strait of Hormuz bleeds commercial traffic, Russian oil becomes more and more valuable. And if you look at the Asia and Europe, and now I think we're seeing this begin to get into North Africa and perhaps other parts of Africa, there is a food, fuel, fertilizer, and feed crisis developing. In other words, the financial economic consequences are building such that if Trump cannot declare victory very soon, the rest of the world is going to come down on him very hard and say, stop, the war is killing us. So that's the first thing. And then when you look at these islands that are targeted, the question you have to ask is, assuming you can get there, what do they do for you? Invasion or blockade of Karg Island? All right, go ahead and do that. What difference is it going to make? That's not the only place where oil can be shipped out by Iran. And if you do this, if you go in great strength into the Persian Gulf, that shuts the movement down, excuse me, of vessels through the straits to zero. Right now, it's dropped off by about 95%. So the 5% that are getting through, tankers headed to India, tankers headed to Japan, tankers headed to China, they'll be stopped as well. Now, China has a substantial reserve of oil, many months left. That's not the case with most everybody else. So I think the whole idea right now is, yes, they want a war-winning offensive. Can they do it from the air? Is an attack inside the Gulf going to do any good? And if they do these things, what else are they going to hit? Are they going to hit desalinization plants and power plants in Iran, in which case everything on the other side of the Gulf, up and down on the eastern side, western side, is going to be destroyed. And it'll take decades to recover from this kind of damage. So I just think a lot of people in Washington are disconnected from reality right now. Most of all, the Pentagon and the president.
I'll throw this out to both of you, colonels. The Pentagon, according to Dave DeCamp, writing, commenting on Axios reporting this afternoon, the Pentagon is developing options for a potential major escalation against Iran that could involve ground troops. U.S. officials and other sources speaking to Axios reporter Barak Ravid, former IDF intelligence officer, described the potential escalation as, quote, a final blow that would give Trump more leverage and room to declare victory, though all indications are that Iran is ready to face ground forces and that any such operation would prolong the war. We heard from the Iranian reports today from Iran saying that they are mobilizing upwards of 1 million fighters for a potential ground war, according to Iranian sources and also being reported by Al Jazeera. So, Colonel Davis, final blow that would give Trump more leverage. But I'm confused because Trump in the past few days has been telling us that this war is over, that we've won, and that any discussion around that is fake news. So why would we have to have an invasion and a final blow if the war is already over? And I'm just confused.
Well, yeah. And this just goes on to show that just the disconnected from reality that President Trump is. And by the way, I wanted to add this one other data point that Doug just mentioned here is the Iran conflict is endangering Taiwan's semiconductor industry by throttling supply of vital materials such as helium, aluminum, and bromine, and crucially energy, as Iran-backed shipping routes jeopardize over a third of Taiwan's Qatari liquefied natural gas, which they need to make these threats. So you're talking about there's also a near-term threat to even to the semiconductor industry. This is just having tentacles all over the global economy, not just the fact of the global, the oil itself. So that's putting pressure literally all over the world that Doug was talking about on President Trump to get this over with. And I think that the allure of having, let's go in with one big blow here and it's going to win it. I'll just tell you, there is no one big blow that you can level. We fired 10,000 strikes so far of everything that we have. And I'm talking bunker busters, these big ones, JASMs, the Tomahawks, you name it. We've been firing everything. And it obviously, it's now almost background noise for the Iranians. They have figured out how to endure this, and they could go on probably indefinitely like this. So the only thing that you could theoretically do is bring in a tactical nuclear weapon. And God help us all if that's the case. If Trump has some idea that he's going to have a big once and for all kind of thing, I don't even know what else you can bring in that even theoretically could bring in one final blow, because there is nothing. You've already attacked everything, and now we're attacking things multiple times in some cases. And so I don't know what they're talking about. There's no conventional answer for that, I'll just tell you. But the pressure on President Trump to get this over with fast is about to start striking big time here at home, in the Middle East, in Europe, and of course, now you see also in Asia. So this is a disaster of epic proportions. It's unfolding before our eyes. And you can understand why President Trump is desperate to get this over with. And that may lead to desperate actions that have even less a chance of success. And I worry a lot about what could be coming.
Doug, I get you to respond to that. I think you're spot on. But where would these troops, do you think, be landing? There's lots of speculation. You mentioned Karg Island. We've had other people say Conorock, which is a port area there. And then Benjamin Netanyahu today released a video where it looks like the backdrop behind him is Conorock, as if sort of like telegraphing or as a feint behind him in his background that, you know, almost like the deception before the Normandy landings. You know, we're going to try to, everyone thinks you're going to land at Calais because it's close, you know, it's as close to the UK as possible. And then you get Monty out there parading around, looking like he's about to lead this invasion across Calais, and then it happens at the Normandy beaches, right? All of this deception was happening. But when you look at the Strait of Hormuz, like, how much deception can there actually be? I mean, you've got Kuwait, but you've got eyes and ears everywhere.
Well, that's the bottom line. Deception, I think, is an impossibility. That doesn't mean that the Iranians have to be everywhere at once. They just have to have numerous weapon systems within range of any of the potential targets, and that's what they've got. They can sit 150 kilometers inside Iran from north to south, and they can take under fire very effectively any of the potential targets that we've mentioned. The question is, first of all, if you're in the Marines, you've got to come ashore. How are you going to do that? Are you going to fly directly from your amphibious carriers or perhaps from the Navy's carriers, fly from there to some point on land? Do you then get out and reorganize and get ready to go and then fly further? I mean, this is a very complex operation. There's not, as Dan said, there's not much time to get ready for it. So I'm hopeful that as we progress in the days ahead, that we can avoid the whole thing altogether. Now, that may not be possible, but here's another data point. This just came into me. This is from Channel 13 in Israel. It was originally in Hebrew. It was translated for me. And it says, the chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Force warned last night in a cabinet meeting, the Israeli army is on the verge of collapse from within. I'm raising 10 red flags, Zamir added. The army now needs a conscription law, a reserve law, and a law to extend mandatory service. The reserves will not hold up. He said these things in front of the prime minister, heads of the security apparatus, and ministers. So I think we have to understand that the nation for which we're fighting, which is really Israel, is a real problem. They've got an enormous problem on their hands. And I don't know how they're going to solve their problems, but we can't solve that problem for them, what happens internally. So bottom line is, I think the whole thing has reached a strategic inflection point. And they have to make a decision pretty quickly because of the economic circumstances as to what they're going to do next. And the notion initially is going to be double down. Keep doing something which has failed thus far in the hopes that it will produce success. I think that's where we're headed. I don't think it's going to produce success.
I want to ask both of you, we have some super chats come in for some questions here. The German Rabbit asks this question. Clayton, ask the colonels how the Russians and the Chinese would react to an American draft mobilization. We saw the increase, obviously, in the enlistment age in the United States. But maybe take that question and then also just the Chinese-Russian piece of this story we heard from President Putin today, saying that what we are about to see from an energy perspective is going to be worse than COVID, and the Russians saying that Europe, the UK, will be begging Russia for oil and natural gas. We heard that from Dmitriev, a diplomat from Russia. So first on just the draft question, Dan, you want to take that one?
Sure. Yeah. Look, I think that would be just domestic disaster. Just try and have a draft. I mean, I think that they have extended the ages here because I think that there are those in the Pentagon and apparently the White House that are saying, hey, if this thing goes south, this war here, I mean, we could just get sucked in and we may need more people. We better start getting them right now. And so you want to try to do that, you know, quietly if you can, by just allowing more people to come in and join by extending the ages here. That's not going to work. Number one, I doubt there are very many people that are in that age that are also qualified and desire to come in. And if you go into a draft situation, I mean, there's a reason why we got rid of the draft that got us out of the Vietnam War and why they went to the all professional military and why we've used it so easily since that way, because you affect such a small portion of the population. But if you now start going back into that to where you're now pulling these, you know, kids from all over the country who have no interest in or desire to serve and force them into a war that they don't, you're going to have a revolt on your hands. I truly believe that. I don't think it would work anymore. I think that day has passed, unless we had a Pearl Harbor type thing where somebody attacked us out of nowhere. And then even then, it wouldn't be, I don't think, the reaction, because our population isn't the same as it was in 1941. So I don't think we would react the same way. But there would be plenty. There would be a number of people that would do that to, you know, to take care of the country. But not this. Not a war of choice that we went into. The only reason you're doing a draft is because you ignored everybody's advice that had any sense, like Doug McGregor, and you went down this path because he was saying, even on my own show several times for months ahead of this, what a disaster this would be, and it's unfolding just like he said, and in some ways even worse. And people would see that then, and they're going to go, no, I'm not going to, like, the you know, send my son or daughter into death here. I mean, we're not going to do that. So I think that if you get to that point, you're going to have a revolt on your hand.
Of course, likely not to have another Pearl Harbor, because now with alternative media and our show, I know I would be immediately out there saying, oh, did the president know about this ahead of time and allow this to happen just like Pearl Harbor? False
good
flag. Like, we, I think, you know, 1941 looks a lot different now with alternative media. I think you would have a disaster on your hands. Doug, what do you think on the draft question and Russia, China in all of this?
Well, first on the draft question, we went to a volunteer army and it had the same impact as going off the gold standard. Once we went off the gold standard, we could print as much money as we wanted and use it any way we wanted to. There was no longer any accountability. There was no longer a need to raise taxes to pay for military operations.
Right.
So that's effectively why we went to the volunteer army, and everybody in Washington loves that. So I see no evidence that they're going to try and draft anybody, because I think Dan's absolutely right. And I can just see that Baron Cameron and Lutnick's children and Witkoff's sons, and let's just go down the list, Kushner's, I can see them all rushing to go fight against Iran for greater Israel. I don't think so. I'd be very surprised.
Right.
So no, I don't see a draft coming at all. Now, then there's the other thing. The Chinese and the Russians have been watching this in disbelief. Everybody thinks, well, there are enemies. Okay. Most of them would just like to do business with the rest of the world, and they're not interested in going to war with us. And I think they view our thinking as incredibly stupid. They can't believe we're doing the things that we're doing. But what they will do, if we continue down this road and there's no evidence whatsoever that we're willing to get off, you will have both Moscow and Beijing will try first to talk directly to President Trump. And they'll say, look, this has got to stop for the sake of the world, for the world economy, for everybody. We don't want Iran to collapse. If you're trying to destroy Iran and you succeed, millions and millions of refugees will pour over the border into Turkey, into Syria, into Iraq. Eventually, they'll find their way to Europe. This is a catastrophe. So we don't want this to happen. You know, I don't think that will get that far, but I'm sure that that's on the minds of both Putin. And I even think the German chancellor, as deranged as he is capable of understanding the implications of that, along with Macron. And I think that's why they both said, forget it. We're not going to participate in this crazy war. But in the final analysis, all of this, unfortunately, rests with Donald Trump. And if he can't find a way to declare victory, then he's going to face a very difficult time in Washington, D.C. This could actually force him out of office. And since everything with him is mortgaged to vanity, I worry a great deal about what Dan mentioned, which is the possibility that somebody says, we'll use a tactical nuclear weapon. And we all know what that means. You use a tactical nuclear weapon, which doesn't, it's a misnomer, it doesn't exist. then others who have nuclear weapons are immediately on alert, and there's a real danger of everybody getting involved. So I hope that doesn't happen.
Got another super chat here.
Clayton, one thing I want to add to that. Sorry, I had a problem with my camera there. Quick move. You talk about China and Russia. There's one thing that hasn't gotten enough focus yet. I'm sure it'll get that way as time goes on. But there's a real problem that is developing that China and Russia are definitely paying attention to. And that is when President Trump and a lot of people have been saying forever, America is the most powerful military history, a country in the history of the world. No one else is even close. Trump says that all the time. And now then they see we can't even bring Iran to its heels. And we can't, we don't have enough ammunition to defend against Iranian missiles. And we don't have enough offensive missiles to do anything that's going to bring them to their heels. I promise you, China's going, okay, if we were worried about the United States, like in a Taiwan scenario or something like that, I think that their fear of us has gone way down, and their recognition that the paucity of our industrial capacity, however, the few amount of missiles we have, the technical limitations of the interceptor missiles, whether that's PAC-3 or THAAD, I think that they're looking at their production rates and their storage rates, and they're going, we can saturate anything you got. And you're keeping your ships far away from Iran, and from, they don't even have a navy effectively. We've destroyed their surface combatants. They still have the speedboats, and they're a big danger to us, despite what we claim. But in terms of a brown or blue water navy, they don't have that. China does. And I think the same thing with the Russians. They're saying, hey, man, if we had to fight you on the European soil somewhere, I think that their confidence and their capabilities it went even higher than it already was, which was pretty high. We are exposing that we are not this incredible military machine. And in fact, we're a lot weaker than people thought, no matter what the president says.
Oh, for sure. I couldn't agree more with you. And I believe Doug agrees with you 100% on that. Here's a question from Blueskin. Says, do you guys think that the military would recall veterans even if they're outside their IRR time?
It's been done before. I think so. A lot of people, when they retire or leave the service, they fill out a form, and the form says, if there's a national emergency or there's a requirement, are you willing to come back and serve? And most people sign that and say yes. So I think I think they could do a lot of things to bring more people back, but it's not the answer. It's not going to change the outcome. This is not a function of how many men under arms you've got. From conception or inception to where we are now is a disaster. It's never been carefully thought through. All of the underlying assumptions were always flawed because we mirror image. We assume that the enemy, whoever it is, always thinks like us. That's never the case. We impute things to the Chinese, to the Russians, we did it to the Germans, the Japanese. It doesn't work. The other thing is that we prefer assumptions we like over the evidence. Instead of digging hard and saying, where's the evidence for this assumption? We say, yeah, I believe that. That's good. Let's go with that. And then finally, there's this tragic, tragic predisposition to dismiss the possibility that it won't work. And then what do you do? How do you get out of it? I mean, if we put all these troops out there, and I know it's only 10,000, still a lot of American manpower and uniform that could be spread across the Persian Gulf and these various islands and places. If it all falls apart, how do we get them out? How do you ensure they have water? How do you replenish the ammunition? I mean, all of this kind of stuff, I just don't think anybody's thought it all through.
Dan, Clayton, let me piggyback off of that.
Yeah, please.
Because the great example of that, one of the points Doug just made about that we are operating on our preference. This is what we would prefer. This is the outcome we'd like to have. And then even if the evidence isn't there, and we certainly don't do any research for it, we just go with it because that's what we want to do. Lindsey Graham has been talking about this a lot by saying, hey, you know, we can take Carg Island. He was seen on, I think it was CBS News over the weekend, I think it was. And they said, hey, look, this Atlantic Journal here says there's a lot of problems going into Carg. And it was a pretty good military assessment of the challenges. And he goes, yeah, I don't care what that Monday morning armchair colonel says or whoever that was. I believe in the U.S. Marines, and they can do Iwo Jima, and they can definitely do this. And I about fell out of my chair because I'm like, dude, the difference between Iwo Jima and Carg Island is about as different as night is from day, and he either doesn't know, doesn't care to know, or doesn't want to find out. It's just like, that's what I want to be true, so it is. And Trump listens to guys like this. And then Keith Kellogg, oh my God, his advice here lately is, yeah, we'll just roll up the Persian Gulf with a couple of Marine ships there and the Boxer and the Tripoli. And yeah, we'll just take the first part and then we'll motor on up the next part like it's no problem. And I'm like, my God, if these are the men that are advising President Trump, no wonder we're making so many bad mistakes.
Yeah, and a point that, Doug, you've been making for a long time is like, you know, we have this 1945 style military that's still built for like a, you know, like a World War II military. So we're going to just roll in more aircraft carriers and that's going to work. You saw what happened with USS, you know, Gerald Ford. So that's what we're going to do. Just have, we're going to be permanently stationed there just off the coast of the island of Hormuz, just making sure that ships are going through and the Iranians won't attack those ships. It's madness.
It really is madness. And the other thing that disturbs me about people like Lindsey Graham, 19,000 Marines died in the Pacific seizing islands. Nobody knows that. You know, I don't think he understands what that means. Frankly, not all of those islands, by the way, needed to be seized. That's another tragedy. And 58,000 airmen died in the 8th Air Force trying to penetrate German air defenses. Now, what I'm trying to get across is, how many ballistic missiles does it take to achieve what I would call mass casualties? If you put 3,000, 4,000 men on a particular island and you can pepper the island with these ballistic missiles, how many of them will be killed? That's the whole point. And what are we asking them to die for? What gives us an assurance that seizing a particular rock in the Persian Gulf is suddenly going to prompt the complete opening and abandonment of the Straits of Hormuz by the Iranians? Well, there's nothing that will do that. And by the way, if you used a tactical nuclear weapon and you think at that point the Iranians would throw in the towel, I've got news for you. I think the opposite would happen. I think they'd be working tirelessly to hurl a nuclear weapon back in our faces as soon as they could develop one or receive one from someone else. So I just don't see anything positive emerging from this succession of events that we're witnessing. This has been wrong-headed from the beginning. And this was something that I think Donald Trump knew he was going to have to do when he was elected because of the people that paid for his election.
Guys, I'll get you out of here in just a minute. I wanted to have you maybe talk. You mentioned it briefly, Doug, just on the Americans killed number. We had Dr. Trita Parsi on the show yesterday who learned that within 24 hours of this outbreak, they had classified the number of casualties. And he made the point that you don't classify casualty numbers if you're happy about those casualty numbers. The numbers of American dead, American wounded have been very tight-lipped from the Pentagon. What are you hearing maybe from your sources, or what's your assessment? Do you believe the official number that they're telling us? Dan, first to you.
No. I don't believe much of what comes out of the government.
Unfortunately, like I said a minute ago, while President Trump is talking about how he has destroyed Iran and they don't even have the ability to launch missiles or drones, as he's speaking, a 10th round was falling on Israel at the moment. So I don't trust a single thing that comes out of him. And, you know, we've seen the Iranians have claimed, and they did again this afternoon, they said there's over 500 American killed and I think like 1,800 wounded or so. I certainly don't take that at face value either. And it could certainly be for domestic cases to make their people feel better. I don't trust a single thing out there. But, man, with all this firepower and when we've had to move out of 13 different bases, according to the New York Times analysis, it just doesn't seem like there's going to be that few casualties. Maybe there is. Maybe we've gotten really lucky. Maybe the defenses have been good. But I trust nothing, unfortunately.
Dan, you brought up the last question that I just was about to ask both of you, which is the New York Times report on these 13 American bases, which the New York Times now says have largely been destroyed. They're uninhabitable. The Iranians yesterday announced that they know that Americans who were stationed there, commanders and soldiers, have fled, and some of them in hiding or outside of those bases, and they are pursuing them, their words, pursuing them, in other words, hunting them down, I would assume. What's your assessment of these American bases in the region? And by the way, they told us they were going to do this in the same way they told us that the Strait of Hormuz was going to be shut down. Like, this is somehow news to the Trump administration. This is kind of shocking. But Doug, first to you on these American bases, this New York Times report.
Well, initially they hit 27 of them. So there were 27 bases damaged. Now they're saying that 13 are totally demolished. They've eliminated all of the expensive early warning radars that we had placed in the region. And this has hurt us badly, particularly in Israel, because they don't get the several minutes of early warning time that they were getting previously. They're hearing, you know, that you've got to get into the underground shelters and you've got like 60 seconds or a minute and a half to get there. And this is taking its toll in Israel. I think, you know, the problem is, once again, we were victims of our own happy, rosy scenario. And I don't know how else to put it, Dan. Do you?
I don't. And, you know, I mean, we're at the mercy of what people in the region are reporting, because, you know, I hardly can trust anything that's coming out of reporters either. But based on the paucity of our responses, I mean, I think it's pretty likely that there's been a lot of casualties. You know, you've got the Navy has been moved back allegedly somewhere around 1,000 miles away from the Iranian shore. So they're not doing anything good. Most of our aircraft, according to reports I'm getting, that we're still doing, despite what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said on like the fourth or fifth day, we're now still doing stand off, because when we try to do stand in, we have what happened with that F-35 the other day. It gets knocked out of the sky, or the MQ-9 Reapers, they get knocked out, which has also stopped making it more difficult to do targeting, because we don't have that persistent stare over there. And everything that we're using so far is a lot less effective than what it's claimed to be. So that's why we circle back around. It seems like the casualties are probably going to be higher, and one wonders if we're ever going to be told the truth.
I guess a final question on Iran's capability, guys, which is, you mentioned the 10,000 strikes so far. We've hit them with just about everything. Is Iran still holding back? Do we still have lots of hypersonic missiles? Do we still have lots? Do they still have this capacity to strike, and they've been holding back in large capacity? Do we have any sense of how much of their munitions have been totally destroyed, downgraded?
Well, my impression is that they have a large number of hypersonic missiles they have yet to fire. That's very clear. They made that clear because they started utilizing older missiles for the purpose of wearing down air and missile defenses, also identifying air and missile defense batteries and radars and so forth. I don't see any evidence that they're about to run out. I mean, if we had believed everything we were told back in 2022, the Russians were running out of missiles and ammunition and tanks and everything else by Christmas of 2022, and the war was going to be over. So again, I go back to Dan. I'm very skeptical of whatever we're told. And remember that the Iranians have spent at least 2+ decades getting ready for exactly this event. So I suspect they have a lot left over. And frankly, don't underestimate the ability of the Chinese in particular, which is a giant manufacturing base, to replenish their losses. I think we have to take that into consideration. You know, Luke Grohman was on the other day, one of my favorite people in terms of financial analysis, and he pointed out, you know, the Chinese have said we can build 1,000 rocket motors for cruise missiles in just one day. We're hard-pressed to build 20 or 30 rocket motors in a week. When you turn to shipbuilding, it's even worse. We may build a few ships a year. They can build, 800 to 1,000 every year. The Chinese manufacturing capability that lies behind Iran is enormous, and we shouldn't underestimate its ability to resupply Iran.
That's unbelievable. So, like, you know, we're not marshaling to tens of thousands of Higgins boats on a moment's notice out of New Orleans, right, Dan?
Yeah, right. That's one of the things I've been warning about for decades, really. In the mid-2000s, I was working for the Future Combat Systems Program in Fort Bliss, Texas, which was supposed to have been this future warfare organization that we put together so we would have a leap ahead, et cetera, after winning the Cold War. And, you know, I watched us show incredible incompetence at being able to manage anything. And so we were trying to have all these gold-plated weapon systems, and literally none of them ever saw the light of day. We never produced anything. And then they said, well, we'll cancel that after, I think, 6 years and $20 billion worth. And they said, all right, we're going to have the ground combat vehicle, use the technology of this, and we'll get something next That didn't work. And then they had another one, then another one. And now we're on, I think it's literally the fifth iteration since 2003 to try to find a next generation leap ahead combat vehicle. And now all we're doing is just continuing to upgrade the M1 from, you know, the 1970s technology, for example. And you look at how long it takes us to build a ship, how long it takes us to build, I think it's like 18 months or something to get just even a handful of THAAD interceptors or so. And we have so many high dollar items, and they take so long. They're so complicated and so expensive. You can't get very many of them. And now when you get in a situation like we are in right now, to where the majority of our PAC-3 interceptors have been used, And as long as the Iranians keep going on with this sustained rate of fire, which they've got, you're going to run out of them. And then you're going to have to go into some of the older stuff that doesn't work as good, like the PAC-2s, for example. And they're going to be even less capable. If we get into some kind of an unexpected conflict with either Russia or China, North Korea, something like that, we are literally going to be hung out to dry, because we can't replace our ships if we lose those. We can't replace our planes if we lose those. And now then, because we have foolishly chosen a war to use the remainder of our stocks after we gave a bunch to Israel since 2023 and to Ukraine since 2022, we're on E right now. And our industrial capacity is still at snail pace. So we have put ourselves in a strategic vulnerability that it's hard to even imagine. And we just have to hope that there is no Pearl Harbor type moment now, because we are going to be in a world of hurt.
Doug, a final question, which is President Trump said, well, the option is unleash hell. They're not going to end this war. No ceasefire. We're going to unleash hell on them. But to Dan's point, what do we have left? What hell could be unleashed other than using nuclear weapons do we have at our disposal at this stage that we haven't basically run out of?
Well, there's no shortage of bluster and bombast and hot air. That's clear.
That's a good point.
I think we will try to ratchet up the intensity of the strikes. In other words, more strikes with more munitions, more missiles in a shorter period of time than we have done in the past. And I think that's really what the pause is all about. The pause is also there so that you can get some more missiles and things out to the fleet and probably to Germany and then ultimately down into the region for the Air Force. That's what's going on. I think that's where we're headed. And that's the only answer they can come up with at this stage. And they're hoping that if they can suppress the enemy long enough that they can safely get Marines and paratroopers into the Persian Gulf to stand on some islands and sort of offer that as evidence for victory. That's about all I can imagine at this stage. And I think that's where we're headed. I don't think it's going to change much. I think things are going to get worse.
And sorry, Clayton, let me jump in real quick. That reminds me of something, Doug, that you told me on our show maybe a month or so before this war came out, is that I had asked you, you know, how long with that much combat power that Trump had assembled there, how long could they go before they have to start replenishing? And you said they can probably go about 2, maybe 3 weeks is what you told me. And now here we are at the 3+ week mark. And now here's this 10-day pause all of a sudden, because you told me they would have to significantly reduce the rate of fire of these things, because then you've used up what you had stored forward, and you're going to have to bring the stuff forward and bring it from other places to include on the ships and in the ground. And I think that's the most likely explanation for this 10-day pause.
Well, I'm glad you explained your question. I was about to say I did not have sex with that woman. I don't know anything about her. I've never met her.
I do need to specify.
Thank you for that clarification. He is a soothsayer, by the way. Gentlemen, Colonel Daniel Davis, Colonel Douglas McGregor, great to see both of you. Thank you so much for this analysis and this deep dive. This is one of those interviews that while I'm sitting here trying to ingest all of your brilliant analysis, I'm going to go back and rewatch my own interview, which I almost never do because I want to go through point by point and take notes, actually. So thanks to both of you for your incredible analysis on all of this. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Good to see you.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks, Dan.